As I thought about what to share this morning, my mind went to the obvious thing. This is the last Sunday of 2024. And frankly, I'm kind of done with 2024 because I kind of got tired of all the political stuff and all the stuff going on. And so I'm kind of looking forward to 2025. 2024 had some disappointments, just the way it is. And for some, it had more than others. For me personally, yes, there were things that were disappointing in 2024. And I've titled this message, Choices. And we want to look at two different men, and the subtitle is Two Men, Two Responses. But I want to share a story before we go into that. We're going to be looking at the first six chapters of Nehemiah this morning. And I talked about Nehemiah 2 weeks ago a little bit. And one of the things that I talked about in that message, I'm going to talk a little more about this morning. But a couple weeks ago, I shared about the death of Merle Wagler, a person that we've known for probably about 15 years. And we didn't know them intimately, but we did know them through some others. Tyson actually worked for Merle for a couple years. Angela's sister, Kim, was with us in Romania one summer. And so there were some connections there that we had with them through some other people. And then we would see them periodically when we were there. Merle and Angela had 12 children. And I think they had two grandchildren. And I always saw Merle as a person who would seek people out. He was a person who just always seemed at peace. And I know that he was a normal person. One of the things that his brother said was, having 12 children, he said, and their family always seemed to be just a calm family. And his brother made the comment during the funeral, he said, I've always wondered how Merle did it. He never disciplines his children. And he said, in having a conversation with the boys after Merle passed away, the boys were like, oh no, don't kid yourself. He disciplined us. So he was a man who was just, he seemed at peace. And I believe he was at peace. I remember one time I was in a group of people and it was a whole lot of new people to me. And I saw him standing over there, and I thought I recognized him, but I was busy doing something. And after a few minutes, he came over, and he made sure that I knew that he recognized recognized me. But as we, Phyllis and I, sat and watched the funeral, we learned some things we never knew about Merle. We knew that he had two children out of wedlock. But that was all we really knew about him. We knew they had 12 children. But 20-some years ago, something happened that changed the course of his life. One Saturday night, Merle was out, and he was still Amish at the time. He was out partying. And on Sunday morning, on the way home, due to a mixture of drugs and alcohol, he fell asleep, crossed the center line, and a 3-year-old girl was tragically killed. Merle was probably about 22 at the time. At the funeral, Angela, his wife, talked about that incident that changed his life. And there are a couple parts of the story that I put together from what was shared there after that, what changed the course of Merle's life. The parents of that little girl showed up in court. And they asked the judge and the prosecutor, they asked for mercy on one condition. The condition was that Merle would go get help. And specifically, they asked that he could go to Fresh Start. Merle went to Fresh Start, and that decision changed the direction of his life. He accepted the Lord, and he made the decision to be a different man. He met Angela while he was at Fresh Start, and they married after he completed his term. I don't know how long that was, but together they raised his two children as one of theirs. There were multiple people that talked at the funeral, and every one of them talked about the different man they knew from the man who was on a downward spiral. He was a man who cared deeply about people and invested in them. And it's interesting that in 15 years, we didn't know that. Never heard it. Because Merle was not that person anymore. We're standing at a brand new year. And I can tell you that I believe 2025 probably will have a few disappointments. There probably will be some things that we look back on at the end of this coming year that we'll wish didn't happen. Maybe some choices we make, maybe things that are totally out of our control. As I thought of that, we come to the new year and people make New Year's resolutions. And most of the time, those resolutions have to do with losing weight, making more money, multiple things. Often they're selfish things. They're not really things that benefit others. They're not bad. They're just not really things that are beneficial to others. And I want to look at the first six chapters of Nehemiah, and we're going to look at a story that I think is a story that speaks to me. It speaks to all of us. And it really doesn't have anything to do with New Year's. It doesn't really have anything to do with resolutions. But there are some lessons here that I can learn. And honestly, as I studied this, there were some things that really jumped out at me personally. And they were personal. And I, as I thought of them, I want to do better. I don't want to allow the things that I saw in my own life to stay there. A key verse that I want to pull out is chapter 2, verse 18. And this is Nehemiah speaking. I also told them, and he's talking to the king, I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon us, upon me, and what the king had said to me. No, he's not. He's talking to the people that he's getting ready to leave with. They replied, "Let us start rebuilding." So they began this good work. I'm going to read. It's a lot of reading. But I think I want to read it. We're going to read. I'm going to go all the way through, and then we'll go back and pull out some high points in these six chapters. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile are back in the province and are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire." When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, "O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and obey his commands, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer, and your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's house, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, 'If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for your name. They are your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I was a cupbearer to the king. I want to stop there. I'll stop after each chapter and kind of recap. So who was Nehemiah? Nehemiah was born in captivity. So all he ever knew was being a slave. He was, and earlier I thought Nehemiah was a prophet or a priest, but Nehemiah was not. He was just a man who had a job in the king's palace, and he was the king's cupbearer, which means he was probably the most trusted man in the kingdom. He was moved to prayer and fasting because in verse 4, the first couple of verses, he saw one of his brother or someone that had come back from Judah. It says one of my brothers, so I don't know if that's actually a family member or just someone that was part of the tribe of Israel. And he asked him, what's happening in Jerusalem? And he said, it's not good. It's not good at all. And so then in verses 5 to 11, he says, for some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then it says his prayer. He asked God for favor with the king to be able to go and prepare, repair, and oversee the wall. In verse 1:11, he says, O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I was a cupbearer to the king. So he was in close communication to the king. Now there's something in chapter 2 that I want you to listen for and pick it up as we read through chapter 2. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you're not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad within the city where my fathers are buried? When the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire, the king said to me, what is it you want? Then I prayed to the God of heaven and I answered the king, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it. Then the king with the queen sitting beside him asked, how long will your journey take? And when will you get back? It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests. So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. By night, I went out through the valley gate toward the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on toward the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through. So I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. They replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you are doing, they asked. Are you rebelling against the king? I answered them by saying, the God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. So this chapter 2 actually starts about 4 months after chapter 1. So it's not, it took time to get there. The thing that was interesting is if you look back into verse 2, the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. So the one thing that I found interesting, it was a hard thing for Nehemiah to come into the king's presence when he was sad, because that was one thing that they were not allowed to do. When they came into the king's presence, they were not allowed to be sad or even to have a sad countenance. And it actually was grounds for firing or actually execution. So this was serious when he came into the king's presence and he was sad. And it was the same thing if you read in Esther 4:2, because they were not allowed, even there, Esther was not allowed to go into the king's presence in sackcloth and ashes. Nehemiah had a quick response when the king asked him what was wrong. He said, the king said to him, what is it you want? His immediate response was, then I prayed to the God of heaven. What did he pray? Matthew Henry says he prayed for wisdom and favor and then asked with humility. Not only did he ask for permission to go help his people, he also asked to be appointed governor. So this is pretty brave for a person who is a servant. He asked for his visa, and he got it. He got his passport. He probably didn't have to wait for 12 weeks to get it or make calls and get it expedited. He got it immediately. The king gave it to him. He asked for written permission to get the supplies he needed from the king's forest. And I think for a slave, that's pretty brave. He's pretty intense on what the mission was. The next question the king asked him was in verse 6, how long are you going to be gone? The king favored him. He not only gave him what he asked for, but he sent an army of officers with him. The king wanted him back. He trusted him explicitly. Nehemiah got there, and he took 3 days to look the situation over to come up with a plan before he went to the leaders of the city. And if you look in verse 17 and 18, you see his approach. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. They replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. So we've learned a little bit about who Nehemiah was. So now who was Sanballat? He was a Samaritan ruler, and his name comes from Sennacherib, which means sin or the moon of God. And if you read on after chapter 6, actually in chapters 10 through 13, you'll find that his treachery didn't stop when the walls were finished. He was determined to destroy Nehemiah. He was determined to take him down. And he even got the Jews to help him to trap Nehemiah in the temple. And Nehemiah found that out. And found out that one of the grandsons of the high priest had married a daughter of Sanballat, and the high priest was driven out of the city as an enemy as well at that time. And that's all in chapters 10 to 13. So now we'll go into chapter 3. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. They dedicated it and set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, which they had dedicated, and as far as the Tower of Haniel. The men of Jericho built the adjoining section, and Zachor, son of Imri, built next to them. The fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hasaniah. They laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Meremoth, son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, repaired the next section. Next to him, Mesullam, son of Bechara, the son of Meshezabel, made repairs. And next to him, Zadok, son of Bana, also made repairs. The next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa out of their nobles, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. The Jeshaniah gate was repaired by Joida, son of Pashina, and Mesullam, son of Besediah. They laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Next to them, repairs were made by men from Gibeah and Mizpah, Melatiah of Gibeon, and Jadon of Meronoth, places under the authority of the governor of Trans-Euphrates. Uzziel, son of Harai, one of the goldsmiths, repaired the next section, and Hananiah, one of the perfume makers, made repairs next to that. They restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Repaiah, son of Hur, ruler of a half district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section. Adjoining this, Jediah, son of Harumph, made repairs opposite his house, and Hattush, son of Hashbaniah, made repairs next to him. Malchijai, son of Haram, and Hashub, son of Paath Moab, repaired another section in the Tower of the Ovens. Shalom, son of Halasheth, ruler of a half-district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. The valley gate was repaired by Hanan, the residents of Zenoa. They rebuilt it and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. They also repaired 500 yards of the wall as far as the dung gate. The dung gate was repaired by Malchijah, son of Rechab, ruler of the district of Beth-Hakkerem. He rebuilt it and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. The fountain gate was repaired by Shalom, son of Kol-Hoseth, ruler of the district of Mizpah. He rebuilt it, roofing it over and putting its doors and bolts and bars in place. He also repaired the wall of the pool of Shalom by the king's garden as far as the steps going down from the city of David. Beyond him, Nehemiah, son of Azbuk, ruler of a half-district of Beth-Zur, made repairs up to the point opposite the tombs of David as far as the artificial pool and the house of the heroes. Next to him, the repairs were made by the Levites under Rehum, son of Bani. Beside him, Hashmai, ruler of half the district of Keilah, carried out the repairs for his district. Next to him, the repairs were made by the countrymen under Benaiu, son of Henadad, ruler of the other half district of Keilah. Next to him, Ezer, son of Jeshua, ruler of Mizpah, repaired another section from a point facing the ascent to the armory as far as the angle. Next to him, Barak, son of Zabai, zealously repaired another section from the angle to the entrance of the house of Eliashib, the high priest. Next to him, Meremoth, son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, repaired another section from the entrance of Eliashib's house to the end of it. The repairs next to him were made by the priests from the surrounding region. Beyond them, Benjamin and Hesheb made repairs in front of their house, and next to them, Azariah, son of Maaseiah, the son of Ananiah, made repairs beside his house. Next to him, Benai, son of Henadad, repaired another section from Azariah's house to the angle in the corner, and Pelei, son of Uzai, worked opposite the angle in the tower projecting from the upper palace near the court of the guard. Next to him, Pedadiah, son of Parash, and the temple servants living on the hill of Ophel, made repairs up to the point opposite the water gate toward the east and the projecting tower. Next to them, the men of Tekoa repaired another section from the great projecting tower to the wall of Ophel. Above the horse gate, the priests made repairs, each in front of his own house, Next to them, Zadok, son of Immer, made repairs opposite his house. Next to him, Shemaiah, son of Shechaniah, the guard at the east gate, made repairs. Next to him, Hananiah, son of Shemaiah, and Hahun, the sixth son of Zalph, repaired another section. Next to him, Meshillam, son of Bechariah, made repairs opposite his living quarters. Next to him, Malchijah, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs as far as the house of the temple servants and the merchants, opposite the inspection gate, and as far as the room above the corner. And between the room above the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and merchants made repairs. A lot of names, and I know I butchered them. But the point is, there were a lot of people that were involved in this work. And who were they? There were priests. There were prophets. There were common people. There were goldsmiths. And it doesn't really say what all they did. But it does say that at one point, there were some people that said, no, we refuse to work with these people. But for the most part, they worked together. And from what I could come up with, it was about one and a half miles of wall that they were rebuilding and that needed to be repaired. And you can imagine how much time that took. And in that chapter, he names about 20 people, but we know that it took way more than that. He doesn't name all the people who put their own work or ideas aside to go to work. And in verse 5, what I just talked about, some of them thought they were above doing what he was asking them to do. We're going to go on into chapter 4. And now the attention turns to Sanballat. When Sanballat heard they were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates in the army of Samaria, he said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble burned as they are?" Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What are they building? If even a fox climbed on it, he would break down their wall of stones. Hear us, O God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their heads. Give them over as plunder in the land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders." So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, and the Arabs and the Ammonites, the men of Ashdod, heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come against and fight Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall." Also, our enemies said, "Before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them and will kill them and put an end to the work." Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, "Wherever you turn, they will attack us." Therefore, I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles and the officials, "The rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes." When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other, and each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. Then I said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, "The work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us." So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. At that time I also said to the people, have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night, so they can serve us as guards by night and workmen by day. Neither I, nor my brothers, nor my men, nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon, even when he went for water. So now Sanballat shows up, and he's angry because what he thought was never going to happen is happening. And he made fun of them. He mocked them. He called them feeble. He said the wall was not going to hold. Even a fox would be able to take it down. And Tobiah was in the same place. He was making fun of them as well. And Nehemiah's response was what? Did you catch it? What was Nehemiah's response? Verse 4. Hear us, O God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their heads. Give them over as plunder in the land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders. His immediate response was to cry out to God. He wasn't looking at himself. He was looking at those people who were working, and he was asking for protection. And in verse 6, it says they continued on with their work. They did not stop in the face of what Sanballat was trying to do. And of course, that made Sanballat even more angry. And he couldn't intimidate them. And then in verse 9, but we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Nehemiah now had recruits to pray. His people prayed. Sanballat understood that they were wearing out, and in verse 11, he plotted again and said, before they know what's happening, we'll swoop down on them and kill them and end their work. And Nehemiah again realizes danger and sets up a defense system where half the men worked while the other half stood guard, and he put an alarm system in place, the first security system that we read of. On into chapter 5. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against the Jewish brothers. Some were saying, we and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain. Now they're running out of food. They were busy building the wall. They're now running out of food. Others were saying, we are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine. Still others were saying, we have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, you are exacting usury from your own countrymen. So I called together a large meeting to deal with them. And as far as possible, we have brought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your brothers only for them to be sold back to us. They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. So I continued, what you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the approach of our Gentile enemies? I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain, but let the exacting of usury stop. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the usury you are charging them, the hundredth part of the money, grain, new wine, and oil. We will give it back, they said, and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say. Then I summoned the priests and made the nobles and officials take an oath to do what they had promised. I also shook out the folds of my robe and said, in this way, may God shake out of his house and possessions every man who does not keep this promise. So may such a man be shaken out and emptied. At this, the whole assembly said, amen, and they praised the Lord. And the people did as they had promised. Moreover, from the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be the governor in the land of Judah until his 32nd year, 12 years, Neither I nor my brothers ate the food allotted to the governor. But the earlier governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them in addition to food and wine. Their assistants also lorded it over the people. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. Instead, I devoted myself to the work on the wall. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table, and as well as those who came to us from the surrounding nations. Each day, one ox, six choice sheep, some poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days an abundant supply of wine of all kinds. In spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor, because the demands were heavy on the people. Remember me with favor, O my God, for all I have done for these people. So in chapter 5 now, because what they were doing, they had put aside their jobs. And they were doing something for the good of all Israel. And they were now having trouble supporting their families. And they needed food. And some of them had mortgaged their farms. And now people were wanting their money back. The government was taxing them. The IRS was active again. And they had sold their family members into slavery. So they had nothing else to give. And they were coming out of slavery. These people were coming back to Israel, and they were coming from the same place that Nehemiah had been. And they were coming out of slavery. So they were slaves, and so there was very little money to be had. And Nehemiah realizes this, and he says, you know what? You're robbing your people. You are now giving Sanballat room for his criticism because you are taking from them and you're charging them interest. The people who had loaned them the money agreed to stop charging interest and gave them back everything that they had charged up to that point. Nehemiah, on the other hand, for the 12 years that he was governor, he chose not to take any pay for what he did. And I don't know, I can't remember if in my reading he ever really gave the king a time frame that he would come back. But he was here as governor for 12 years. So in chapter 6, which is where we're going to end, is the last part of what we're going to talk about with Sanballat. When the word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall, and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message, "Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono." But they were scheming to harm me, so I sent messengers to them with this reply. "I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you?" 4 times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. Then the 5th time, Sanballat sent his aide to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it's true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king, and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. Now this report will get back to the king, so let us confer together." I sent him this reply, "Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You're just making it up out of your head. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. One day I went to the house of Shemaniah, son of Delilah, the son of Methabel, who was shut up in his home. He said, 'Let us meet in the house of God inside the temple. Let us close the temple doors because men are coming to kill you by night. They are coming to kill you.' But I said, 'Should a man like me run away? Or should one like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go.' I realized that God had not sent him, but that he prophesied against me because of Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this. Then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. Remember, Tobiah and Sanballat, oh my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who have been trying to intimidate me. So the wall was completed on the 25th day of Iyul in 52 days. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized this work had been done with the help of our God. Also, in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them, for many in Judah were under the oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Ara, and his son Johanan, who had married the daughter of Meshula, son of Bechariah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds and telling him what I said, and Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. It seems pretty obvious that Sanballat had an agenda here. And what most writers believe was that Sanballat's agenda was that he wanted to take over Israel, and he wanted to be its king. He also, here in chapter 6, it's obvious that he had spies working within the people to try to intimidate Nehemiah. And Nehemiah continued to cry out to God. He continued to, that was his first response. In conclusion, J. Vernon McGee shares five things that we can gain from this account. Number one, Nehemiah was a layman. He was a common man. He had a job, not a high-paying job, but he had a job with a lot of security. All his needs were taken care of. He didn't have to worry about a thing. This was the third attempt to rebuilding the walls. The other two were a priest and a prince, who were unable to complete the task. And it doesn't tell us why. It just says they were unable to complete the task. Nehemiah was considered just a common man. He was considered a man who was important in the king's palace, but when it came to who he was, his name was not recognized because of where he was. The second thing that J. Vernon talks about is Nehemiah believed in watching and working. Nehemiah believed in prayer. His first instinct was to pray. When he hit the wall, that was the first thing he did. And what I found interesting, in the short book of Nehemiah, it gives 14 instances where Nehemiah cried out to God for help. So Nehemiah believed that God heard his prayers. When he was in trouble, when he needed help, he went to God. J. Vernon makes this comment. What a fabulous example of how to get something done. Pray before you start. Pray as you go. Pray when you're between a rock and a hard place. Pray about everything. The third thing is he cared about the things of God. Nehemiah was deeply concerned about God's cause. One day while he was busy in the palace, he encountered a brother who had just returned from Jerusalem. He stopped him and wanted to know, how are things going in the land? And the response was not good. And that troubled him because he was concerned about God's cause. His typical practice, he prayed about it. He said, Lord, if you want to use me, I am making myself available to you. When God opened the door for him to speak to the king, he didn't mind asking for the king's officials' help and protection along the route. The fourth thing that J. Vernon says is God leads people in different ways. And that's the thing that's hard for us to always get a grip on. God's going to use every one of us in a different way. And some of us, it may seem like our role is not as important. But is that a trick? Is that a tactic that Sanballat would have used to get us to believe that we don't matter? Yeah, I think so. Because it doesn't matter who we are, there is a purpose for every one of us. And this is J. Vernon's a comment from him. He said, I made a mistake at the beginning of my ministry by trying to imitate a certain preacher. He was highly successful and a man of God. One day an elder of my church said, "Vernon, we would rather have an original Vernon McGee than an imitation of anyone else. From that day on, I have not tried to imitate anyone, and the Lord help the man who would try to imitate me." And the last one is be faithful. The rebuilding of the walls and the gates of Jerusalem was one of the greatest building projects we've ever heard of, 52 days. What Nehemiah did was a tremendous thing, and it was a wonderful testimony of God working through individuals. It was hard work. It took a lot of people. Many made significant sacrifices for God. Remember, my friend, God takes note of it all. Many unknown Christians will be called before the judgment seat of Christ and rewarded. You think of preachers and missionaries and other church workers as receiving the great rewards. But I think that some of the greatest rewards will go to the unknown saints who live for God in this day. And Dylan made a comment in Sunday school, we need to live in the moment. That's where God uses us. He uses us in the moment. In this story, we have two different men and two different responses. Sanballat was a man who had his own plans and dreams. Some writers suggest he had plans to take over Jerusalem himself one day, and this was the reason the walls had not been rebuilt. Sanballat had infiltrated the city of Jerusalem, had a network of people who were good at causing discord among the people and keeping things in disarray. Nehemiah, on the other hand, was a man of integrity who realized he could do nothing without God's help. He was a man of utmost character, persistence, and prayer. He was a man who was secure and successful as the king's cupbearer. He had little power or authority in his job, but the king trusted him like no other man. He was also a man of God who was concerned about the city of his fathers, and from the beginning of this book to the end, he never hesitated to cry out to God and ask for help, and never hesitated to ask God to remember him. Because of Nehemiah's persistent trust in God, the enemies of God were defeated. There are times in all of our lives when we feel unappreciated and unused. Nehemiah was a common man. The rebuilding of the wall took many common people to complete. And this morning, at the beginning of this new year, the question is, am I Sanballat or am I a Nehemiah? And maybe instead of making New Year's resolutions, I would challenge us to take the example of Nehemiah to fast and pray, to find out what God wants us to do, to cry out to God, to be ready to pray when we are against the wall. We all know the verse, Jeremiah 29:11. "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." Think about this. Nehemiah had a lot of things that he could have used as excuses. "I'm a slave. I can't change my status. It's not my fault. I was born here." He did not allow that to stop him. Your past cannot define your future unless you refuse to change your present. Brian, do you have a song?
The hymn is 606.
606. You can stand. Father, this morning, thank you for the lessons in this book. Thank you for the lessons for our lives, and help us to take them to heart. Help us to look at our own lives, to take inventory of who we are, but most of all, to place our trust 100% in you and to allow you to use us in the moment. Go with us this week. Help us to honor you in all that we do. Help us to be people of integrity, to reach out, to seek people out, to make a difference in their lives. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.